on the humid side in the 80s, 70s on the Cape and the Islands. This is WBUR.
Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Gina Cervetti. Tonight, from last semester's Institute for Philosophy and Religion series entitled The Stranger's Religion, Fascination and Fear, Dean of Theology Robert Neville examines the structure of various belief systems and their impact in a pluralistic world. Speaking now on the subject, Toward a Theology of World Religions, The Existential Threats, is Dean Robert Neville.
To be asked to speak in this year's Institute series on the stranger's religion is an honor for which I'm deeply grateful. The cumulative run of Institute series that Leroy Rauner has created is a remarkable cultural achievement. Throughout a period when specialization has defined academic excellence, with the legitimation of boundaries between disciplines by so-called methodological differences, Rauner's Institute has struck an alternative course. For Rauner, the important topics are not defined by the evolution of the disciplinary agendas in philosophy, theology, or religious studies. They are defined rather by enduring human issues of both chronic and acute urgency. For their understanding and resolution, the issues themselves determine what disciplines are relevant, how, and where. Speakers in these Institute series need to be public intellectuals, responding to the shape of the issues, rather than disciplinary experts who say only what their home discipline might contribute. Although some of us might intend modesty in attempting to limit work within the boundaries of an academically accredited discipline, this, in fact, would be the hubris of preserving purity while the issues go unaddressed or partly addressed. True humility in the life of the mind is to let the issues dictate the need for disciplinary inquiry. The consequence is that we must keep our repertoire of disciplines in a constant state of revision, with sensitivity to the issues at hand as well as to the history of their evolution. And we must think collaboratively with colleagues who can insist on the highest standards of inquiry in disciplines where we can only borrow expertise. Moreover, we must always be aware of the limitations in the integrity with which we address issues. Not that we should fear bastardizing our disciplines, but that even with the most sensitive integration of disciplines at our disposal, we still might miss the core of the issues at hand. By framing the Institute series as he has over these many years, Leroy Rauner has led an anti-Kantian counter-revolution. Bet he didn't know that. Kant's famous Copernican revolution was to abandon the response of curiosity to nature and affirm, quoting Kant now, that reason has insight only into that which it produces after a plan of its own, and that it must not allow itself to be kept, as it were, in nature's leading strings, but must itself show the way with principles of judgment based on fixed laws, constraining nature to give answer to questions of reason's own determining. End of that quote. Although Kant attempted to justify a generous and universal sense of reason, in practice, his philosophy has said that nature must be constrained to fit into what our methodologically defined disciplines can represent. What cannot be represented in those disciplinary terms can be dismissed as unreal. Kant intended to say only that it is necessary to explain things causally within the disciplines of science in order to distinguish that part of our consciousness which is objectively real from that which is mere fantasy. Nevertheless, dismissal as mere fantasy is dismissal into irrelevance. Thus, one part of Kant's legacy is that the treasure of brilliantly imaginative disciplines of inquiry developed from the Enlightenment to our own day, has been turned into a plague of reductionisms. One discipline says, if it's not frogs, it doesn't count. Another says, if it isn't flies, it doesn't count. Or if it isn't boils, it doesn't count. Or hail, or locusts, or red tide in the river, or the death of the firstborn. We've had astrophysical reductionisms, biological reductionisms, sociological reductionisms, anthropological reductionisms, psychological reductionisms, economic reductionisms, historicistic reductionisms, literary critical theory reductionisms, phenomenological reductionisms, and philosophical reductionisms to justify all the other reductionisms. What should be an enormously rich and varied set of continuously evolving and interacting self-critical tools of inquiry had become, by mid-20th century, an array of separated disciplines, each depreciating the method-subject matter links of the others, because they were not harnessed to the leading strings of its own rational constructions. These barriers now have been battered down considerably by the consequences of their own silliness, by fatigue in the fad of doing micro-studies in so many fields that made a virtue out of blindness to external questions, and by renewed interest in systematic connections of kinds of knowledge. Nevertheless, the reintegration of disciplines cannot be effected by thinking about the disciplines themselves only. It must come from engaging the issues of existence, including intellectual issues, whose very shape can dictate cooperation and congruence among modes of inquiry. Leroy Rauner has seen this and done something about it with his distinguished series. Another part of Kant's legacy is that the focus on disciplines blinds us to realities for which we have no intellectual leading strings. Until, like airliners smashing into the Twin Towers, the realities ruin the world we thought we understood. Then we realize that we should have looked around with more curiosity and wonder and less ambition to constrain nature with our rational constructions. Although Kant believed in pure science for its own sake, we know that science costs money, and that money comes mainly from agencies who want to know for the sake of some interest. We do not have to agree with postmodern or Nietzschean critiques of Western culture to see that rational constructions, the questions we force upon nature, serve human interests, noble and otherwise. What I have just said might seem a long and irrelevant introduction to a talk on theology of world religions, but it's not. It is long, but it's not irrelevant. One of the most comprehensive and disastrous reductionisms of our time is theological. By theology here, I do not mean just academic theology, although that has been reductionistic enough, but also the theology of our leaders in government and business, the theology of ordinary religious people, the theology of our intellectual elites, and the theology of people for whom religion means little or nothing. The reductionism of common theology in all these groups is that the terms of their own religion constitute the leading strings by which they register the religions of others. Even people who reject the religion of their ancestral culture are constrained by the terms of that religion to understand religion in general. Of course, there are exceptions to this reductionism in all the groups mentioned. Nevertheless, it is shocking how parochial, even sophisticated people in business, government, or the academy can be about the religions and cultures of people different from themselves. In a moment, I'll say why this is so. Well, reductionism in theology is not Kant's fault. Of course, it antedates him by centuries and flourishes in East and South Asian cultures, as well as Muslim countries around the globe that have been little affected by Kant or the interests of the Enlightenment until recently. What Kant did is explain in his exhortation to constrain nature to the leading strings of our rational constructions is how theological reductionism works. The religions of others are recognized only insofar as they conform to one's own religion's categories. Theological reductionism is not simple ignorance, although ignorance can have the effect of reductionism. Rather, theological reductionism consists in a privileging of one's own religion's categories for defining what is important in religion and what other religions must be saying, meaning, and doing. The privileging, of course, comes from believing that one's own religion is true, or that one's ancestral religion is the important one to reject. Many forms of this privileging exist. A common way to catalog them comes from the simplistic distinction between exclusivist, inclusivist, and pluralist theologies of religions. Exclusivists believe that only their religion is true, and this belief itself has many forms. The most common and unsophisticated form adopts some kind of internal authority, such as a scripture, that proclaims an exclusive truth, and then concludes that the other religions simply can be ignored for all religious purposes. All that is necessary to know about other religions is that they miss the truth of one's own. Sometimes more knowledge is required if the others are to be combated, and often much more knowledge of the others is required if one wants to convert them to one's own religion. Many Americans on the religious right are exclusivists in something like this last sense. The great missionary movements of the late 19th and 20th centuries found this kind of exclusivism hard to abide, however. Inquiry into other religions for the sake of converting their adherents led, in fact, to respect for the others, recognizing many kinds of difference. Sophisticated kinds of exclusivism, by contrast with the unsophisticated kinds content with ignorance, can actually engage in a more or less thorough review of the alternatives and conclude that one is in fact the best, adopting it as one's own. Sometimes sophisticated exclusivism can be of a conservative bent. Think of the spiritual odyssey of Cardinal John Henry Newman. Other times it can be radically liberal, as in those religious movements that reject all others as pedestrian, authoritarian, or warmongering. One thinks here of some mystical movements, some Anabaptists, some Unitarian Universalists, or the Baha'i movement. Cultural elites, who like to be spiritual, though not religious, are often liberal exclusivists. Of course, these left-wing exclusivists are syncretistic and include many elements of other religions. Their main regard for the other religions, however, is negative and dismissive. Insofar as sophisticated exclusivism does in fact engage with other religions before making a judgment, it is not reductionistic in principle. Inclusivism is the view that one's own religion includes the whole or best truth, and that other religions have partial or alternative versions of this, with a positive regard for those other religions. The classic example is the Muslim theological position toward Christianity and Judaism, which are regarded as having partial, though valid, revelations. Theologians of the Second Vatican Council of the Roman Catholic Church became inclusivistic in regarding Protestants and Orthodox as separated brothers and sisters, and found people in other faiths to be anonymous Christians. This was offensive to Protestants and Orthodox, who thought it was Rome that had gone wrong, and to people of other faiths who had no desire to be Christians at all. Nevertheless, it allowed Roman Catholicism to say that significant truth exists in other religions and that they are all true in important ways that Catholic theology can express. The difficulty with inclusivism is that it is nearly always viciously reductive. One's own religion dictates the criteria for truth that are fulfilled in other religions, at least in part. Judaism and Christianity are true within Islam because their sacred texts are also sacred with the Islamic canon. Roman Catholicism finds Christian-like traits in practitioners of other religions, and so on. When in a generous mood, most of us are anxious to find what we know to be true on our own terms in the faith of other people through analogies of belief and practice. All these are reductive practices because they ignore elements in other religions that do not register in one's own theology, yet are important in the others. The major exception to the claim that inclusivism is generally reductive is the position that all religions really are about the same thing, that they differ in the historical evolution of their symbols, and that they agree to the extent that they address the ultimate reality with symbols that transcend historical differences. John Hick is famous for maintaining such a position in our own time. Yet the whole tradition of perennial philosophy holds to this point. From ancient Neoplatonic lineage in the West down to Houston Smith, a regular in the Institute series, with parallels in Indian philosophy down to Ramakrishna's version of Vedanta, and in Islamic philosophy down from Jabir to Sayyid Hossein Nash, perennial philosophy has claimed that reality has a hierarchy of levels. On the lower levels, historical differences are undeniably important. On the higher levels, obtainable by mystical experience and transcendent philosophical reflection, however, the different religions testify to the same truth. The perennial philosophy does not use any one religion's theology for rational construction with which to interpret the rest. It uses its dialectical philosophy to interpret all religions. Perennial philosophy is reductive on its own terms, therefore, when the valuation implicit in its hierarchy of levels of reality serves to trivialize elements that are mightily important in specific religious traditions. Concern for Jerusalem, or Benares, does not register as important on the perennial scale, though they are very important for some religions. Pluralism is the theology of religions that says that they are all true somehow. Being true somehow means that each religion gets to define truth in its own terms. Pluralism exhibits a generous spirit of tolerance that says that every tradition has a significant history, with a significant history, must have a handle on some important religious truth, and therefore is to be respected and honored for that. People often come to a pluralistic theology of world religions by participating in interfaith dialogues with deep thinkers of other faiths, finding that they have more in common with them than they do with the schlubs of their own tradition. Schlubs is an important category in comparative theology. Pluralism is nearly always a reductive theology, however, because it says that in principle, serious disagreements are not about matters of truth. While claiming to avoid an inclusivist claim to a common core of truth among religions, it also avoids claiming that differences among religions can be over matters of serious truth. The exception to this claim that pluralism is reductive as regards important truth would be positions that have thoroughly studied all religions, found that they are all unique, and that each is true in its own way. Although this is an ideal for many scholars of religion, at this point in time, it is absurd because there is as yet no scholarly basis for it. The world religions are only barely comparable, let alone analyzable, in terms of detailed criteria for different areas of truth. Pluralism is absurd at an even more obvious level. I have never met a Christian who believes that all forms of Christianity are equally true. Jewish theology is no more unanimous than Israeli politics. Islam is notoriously divided into factions. Six Orthodox schools exist in Hinduism, plus many others, each claiming its interpretation of the Vedas is correct. Buddhism is notoriously divided into competing schools. Taoist religious sects dispute about their scriptures. Confucians have at least two main schools in China, with multiple variants in other national cultures such as Korea, Japan, Vietnam, and California. If none of these big seven religions is unified theologically within itself, how can pluralists say that they all have their own truths? The only way to do so is to impose some inclusivist model of what counts as true and use this to interpret what is really important in each religion, which of course reduces away the very elements that have led to diverse and frequently bellicose denominationalism within the various traditions. In point of fact, the distinctions between exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism are formal to the point of being pernicious rather than helpful. They treat religions as if they were homogeneous, bounded entities that can be represented by the token of a religion or a tradition. Nothing in reality corresponds to conceptions of religions as homogeneous, bounded entities, except perhaps the religion of some tribe that has no neighbors and has never been discovered by scholars. All the religions of the world have interacted with others, borrowing and transforming themselves in the process, while influencing the others at the same time. Moreover, religions are not static ways of life lived for their own practice and beliefs. Rather, they are ways of practice and belief that engage the realities of life, constantly being transformed by reinforcement or negation in that engagement, constantly in competition with neighboring ways of life for the direction of engagement. The categories of pluralism, inclusivism, and exclusivism are pernicious because they deny that religions are constantly alive, constituting moving targets for analysis. The categories essentialize living existential realities. They identify religions through mere themes rather than through engaged life. They reduce living religions to static positions on some chart whose X and Y axes are defined by one's own religion, by some superior conception of what counts as religion, which amounts to one's own religion, or by a genial nominalism that says that any religion that claims to be a religion is acceptable on its own terms. Therefore, we need to abandon the formalistic categories of exclusivism, inclusivism, and pluralism and take a new approach to the theology of world religions. Yet we can learn from the difficulties of that formalistic classification. The first thing a new approach needs is a better way to study the boundaries of world religions, to identify in what they consist and how they differ. I commend an historical approach based on the analysis of core texts and motifs. I propose that we study the emergence of key religious ideas from the prehistoric past, their expression in core texts, and the different ways by which those texts have been interpreted and reinterpreted throughout history, interacting with interpretive traditions also formed from other core texts and motifs. The ancient Vedas, for instance, evolved through perhaps a 1,500-year history before taking the oral form expressed in the written forms we have now. Their older elements were interpreted by the later Upanishadic movements, still in the Vedas, that systematized them into a way of life quite different from the cultures of their origins. Buddhism and Jainism arose as revolutions against the authority of the Vedas, soon collecting their own canon of the teachings of their founders, and then of their schools of interpretation, and then of the debates among the schools of interpretation, and so forth. Meanwhile, the heirs of the Upanishadic traditions reorganized into what we now call Hinduism to reaffirm the authority of the Vedas. As I mentioned, there are six orthodox schools of Hinduism, including Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Sankhya, Yoga, Purvamimamsa, and Vedanta, the last having three main branches associated with the leadership, respectively, of Shankara, Ramanuja, and Madhva. You're not supposed to remember those names. I just want to show you how many there are. Meanwhile, the resurgent Vedic tradition interacted with the older pre-Aryan forms of Indian religion to produce the textual tradition of the Bhagavad Gita and the other religious practices focusing on the worship of Shiva and Krishna and a host of other deities. All of these traditions evolved in continuing debate with the many diverging and ramifying branches of Buddhism until the latter was virtually eradicated in India, moving to Tibet and China. By studying how the ancient texts were used differently, interpreted differently, and whose fortunes led to the divergence of different schools, it would be possible to see how the religious situation we have now has been formed by different roots, entangled, and divided at different points in history. The real identity of any contemporary religious group needs to be understood in terms of the complex history that has led to it. When Buddhism came to China, it was first in a popular form in which the Buddha was added to the Chinese deities on Taoist funerary vessels, according to our earliest records. There were the Taoist gods and then Buddha. Elite Buddhism came to China with its Sanskrit texts that were translated into Chinese with the Taoist vocabulary. Nestorian Christianity came to China a few centuries later with the same translation vocabulary. The Gospel of John began, "In the beginning was the Tao." China tempered the factionalism of Indian Buddhism with the need for bureaucratic harmony that came from imperial success. For nearly 800 years, Buddhism was a major player in Chinese imperial politics, sometimes overshadowing the more ancient Chinese traditions of Confucianism and Taoism. Indeed, the Chinese schools of Confucianism and Taoism came to self-consciousness as Chinese over against the foreign religion of Buddhism, and as different from one another only with the arising of Neo-Confucianism in the Song Dynasty. Meditative practices of Song Neo-Confucianism owe more to Buddhism than to antique Confucianism, and its metaphysical concerns about principle and material force and the opposition to nothingness owe more to the debates between Taoists and Buddhists than to the texts of Confucius, Mencius, or Shenzhen. To understand contemporary Confucianism requires understanding that evolving history in which India, with its rejected Vedas, was almost as important as China in the splintered legacy of the I Ching. As to understanding the West Asian religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, we cannot limit ourselves to the Hebrew Bible, New Testament, and the Quran genealogy. Prophetic, apocalyptic, as interpolated into Isaiah, came from the dualistic Zoroastrianism the Jewish exiles encountered in Persia. Did Ashoka's Buddhist mission that reached Egypt in the 4th century inspire Ecclesiastes? How much of the metaphysics of wisdom in Proverbs and Sirach came from Hellenistic thought? Paul's view of Jesus as a demigod had its origins in paganism, rather than the anti-idolatry Levitical code that abhorred the touching of corpses, only slightly less than the appearance of resuscitated ones. Christmas was a Roman Saturnalia, and Easter a Norse goddess. Good history allows us to identify the roots of religions and the reasons in dialogue, debate, and historical influence of their current shape. It blows apart essentialist definitions of wholesale religious traditions required for the exclusivist, inclusivist, pluralist discussion. The second thing a new approach to theology of world religions needs is to develop fair and stable comparative categories. Theological reductionism manifests itself most in the academic study of religion by defining religion and its important elements according to European Enlightenment models, mainly deistic and derived from Christian and Jewish sources. To develop proper comparative categories is the responsibility of the academic community. Treating candidate categories as hypotheses to be tested for their neutrality and friendliness to the religious elements being compared. Three stages in the development of proper comparative categories need to be distinguished and evolved with care. First, we need to develop properly vague categories, categories that have some historical baggage, no other kind exist, but that are redefined so as to be not biased toward one kind of religion rather than another. The process of the purification of vagueness is complicated and requires the criticism of candidate definitions of the categories from the sides of those positions that feel themselves to be distorted or marginalized by the categories. A vague category, properly understood, tolerates instantiation by specific instances that might themselves contradict one another. The category of ultimacy, for instance, tolerates representations of highly anthropomorphic gods as well as highly abstract principles such as the Tao. The second stage of developing comparative categories is in fact to instantiate or specify them with the positions to be compared. The category of ultimacy has instantiation across a wide spectrum from anthropomorphic polytheism to monotheism to what some scholars call henotheism, the dominance of one god over a pantheon, to Advaita conceptions, to Shangdi, the Chinese sky god, heaven, the Tao, and abstract principal material force in Neo-Confucianism. The category of ultimacy also needs to register the Madhyamaka Buddhist complaint that nothing at all is ultimate in an ontological sense, and that concerns for ultimacy are the root of human suffering. Once the vague category of ultimacy is specified in a multitude of ways, it is possible to say just how those ways agree, disagree, overlap, or are irrelevant to one another. This is the third stage in the development of a comparative category, the laying out of the similarities and differences among positions compared. The positions are not wholesale religions, but specific manifestations of them. Each religion might have manifestations of the category along a wide spectrum of instances. Commonalities along the spectrum of representations of ultimacy might cross religious boundaries rather than reinforce them. Typological comparisons of religious positions are not adequate for a theology of religions, however necessary they are to get the enterprise started. We also need a procedure for identifying how theologies can be true or false. For this part of the project, I recommend a program I call Theology of Symbolic Engagement. The phrase symbolic engagement refers to the fact that people engage the religious dimensions of life by means of symbols. Symbols shape their thinking as well as perceptions and behavior. Symbols structure what people take for granted and how they negotiate the differences between foreground objects of attention and the background that gives them meaning. Symbols are the principal vehicle by which tradition is passed down from generation to generation. Religious symbols are the means by which we identify religious belief and behavior. Intellectual symbols for theologies verbal symbols for religious texts and their various uses, liturgical symbols for shaping personal and communal religious practice, moral symbols as precepts for living, symbols of dress, movement, gestures, definitions of social roles, goals and authorities, and a host of other things. The analysis of symbols is vastly complex, but these lists indicate something of its range. The symbols direct how people engage the religious dimensions of life. The definition of the religious dimensions of life is itself a difficult theological topic, but for our current purpose, we can leave it relatively undefined. It probably has to do with how we live before the ultimate, how we live in terms of ultimate matters. But that is a topic for another time. The general rubric for understanding religious engagement is interpretation. Interpretation, like symbol, is a broad notion. Cognitive interpretation is where we take a symbol to stand for its object in a certain respect, and that taking results in or has the form of an intellectual claim. Interpretation takes the form of action, however, when we take the object to call for a response, as when we interpret a joke with a laugh, or duck when something is symbolized as threatening. Emotions, enjoyments, sufferings, queries, and many other human responses are interpretations of objects by means of symbols that we take to stand for the objects in a certain respect. At any given time, a human being is making at least a bazillion related interpretations. That's a very large number, twice a zillion. Our kinesthetic interpretations keep us moving through a world of objects with gravity. Our perceptual interpretations pick out what we have evolved to take as important objects to discriminate in an environment of proximate visible light. Sometimes we think about what we see, a kind of intellectual interpretation, but more often we see what we need to in order to keep on our track of thinking. Our interpretations are organized according to our purposes and needs. But purposes and needs take place within an inherited and appropriated culture with its values and semiotic distinctions. And they rest with the interpretive habits of our bodies. Imagine the density of the bazillion interpretations going on when you drive a familiar winding road, for instance, the Jamaica Way, thinking about the theology of world religions and not reflecting on what you see, but still seeing the twists in the road, judging the other driver's intents, kinesthetically feeling when to brake or accelerate, and suddenly turning attention to the driving only when you get downtown and have to find a parking place. Think of the interpretive values and purposes that put you in the car in the first place, heading downtown, and thinking about theology. Our engagements with all dimensions of reality are shaped by symbols actually used in context to interpret them. Interpretations refer symbols to objects in a variety of ways, often many ways together. The philosopher Charles Saunders Peirce distinguished three important ways. One form of reference is purely conventional, and is determined by one's culture's semiotic system. Religion is a family of subsets of a semiotic system, and religious symbols are interdefined with semantic and syntactical structures, structuring how one symbol can refer to another. Another form of reference is what Peirce called iconic, as an icon, and it is when reality is taken to be like what the symbol is. His example was the cross in church that is iconic of the cross on which Jesus was crucified. The notion of iconic reference is more general, however, in that any description, even a theoretical one, supposes that its object is like what it describes. The third form of reference Peirce called indexical, which means pointing. As when a person points something out and you turn your head to look, an indexical reference establishes a causal connection between the object and the interpreter so that the interpreter does engage the object. If interpretation always requires engagement, there must be an element of indexicality in most interpretations. Religious symbols are particularly important to notice in their indexical reference, because so many of them are aimed to transform the interpreter so as to make accessible something religiously important. Most people, ordinarily, are religiously blind, skating on the surface of ultimate matters. Deep religious symbols, learned in scriptures, liturgies, religious speech, and specific practices, are aimed to transform the soul over time so as to be able to grasp what is really important religiously. Religious interpretations are true when they do two things. First, they have to genuinely engage their objects. And second, they have to carry what is important or valuable in the religious object over into the interpreter in the respect in which the symbols represent the object. Many people complain that traditional religious symbols today do not engage people. They can be used in interpretations in church or synagogue, but without real engagement, only as habitual thought patterns. Or perhaps the symbols are engaging for some people, but not for others, as when persons abused by their fathers cannot engage God with the symbol Father, even though they know intellectually what the symbol is supposed to mean. Suppose that the symbol does engage, however. Suppose that's true. Does it do so truly? That means, I want to argue, that within the interpretation, it carries over what is valuable or important in the respect the religious object is being interpreted. The symbol is false within that interpretation if it carries over something else. In order to tell whether the right thing is carried over, we need some other kind of corroboration, which is why interpretations are set within reinforcing and corrective interpretive frameworks. In religious matters, the discernment of what is really carried across and whether it is true is often difficult, because a symbol means one a symbol that means one thing for one person can mean something entirely different for another. What the symbol means actually depends not only on the interdefinition of symbols in the semiotic system, but on what it means in the context of the actual interpretation, surrounded by cultural values and human purposes. The meaning of the symbol also depends on the mode of reference involved and the respect in which the symbol is taken to refer to the object in that specific interpretation. So, only concretely contextualized interpretations can be true or false. Some contexts are very nearly universal, such as those within which mathematical judgments are made. Others aim to be universal, such as scientific contexts sometimes. Religious contexts, by contrast, are highly specific and particular. Why? In the first place, the meaning systems of their symbols are historically particular. Jews and Christians can dispute about whether Jesus was the Messiah because they share the evolution of that office in Israelite religion and interpret it differently in terms of the affairs of the Second Temple, Judaism. The symbol of the Messiah would neither engage nor be true or false for Buddhists or Confucians unless they adopted the history of Israel, as Paul's Gentile Christians did. In the second place, the modes of reference in religion depend greatly on indexicality, and the causal connections established by indexical reference are particular. The connections either are made or they are not. In the third place, religious groups have their own historical and social contexts, with variations in social location, generational characteristics, and a host of other variables. Some religious claims might be unique in context to an individual. People in the same religion, in the same community, even in the same cohort, in the same family, might interpret the same religious dimension with the same symbol, and yet have that be true for some individuals and false for others because of their existential differences. The result of this is that the theological assessment of religious truth applies to real interpretations and is always contextual. The context for any interpretation involves at least three elements I have mentioned: the symbol systems involved, the modes of reference involved, and the actual social and personal location of the interpreter with layers of values and purposes. To judge whether an interpretation is true, it's necessary to identify all of these to see whether what is important in the object of the interpretation is carried over into the interpreter. One part of theology is the assessment of truth in religious interpretations, and so it is a theological obligation to identify these, and most likely other elements I haven't figured out, to see whether the interpretations are engaging and true. Theology in this sense requires the work of anthropology, sociology, psychology, neurophysiology, and history, as well as theology in the old-fashioned sense. In this light, the theology of world religions is suddenly transformed from the formal abstractions of exclusivism and inclusivism and pluralism. No need exists at all to suppose that religions are bounded entities. Rather, look in particular contextualized interpretations to see just what symbol systems are in play. They might be central to a textbook religion, but they surely will not be the whole of the symbols that show up in the textbook. Moreover, they are likely to arise from contextualized biases within the textbook religion, as Protestants take different slants on Christian symbolism from the Orthodox and the Roman Catholics, not to speak of the Nestorians, the Monophysites, or the African independent churches. The theology of a Protestant living next door to a Buddhist or a Jew is likely to be different in the shadings of its symbols from the theology of a Protestant who knows only Protestants. Theological assessment of truth should be sensitive to the actual symbol systems involved, as it is to differences in social context and personal existential situation. Because of the very great importance of religion in today's affairs, theological assessment of religious truth is an issue of commanding importance, a crucial task for public intellectuals. This robust conception of theology, as in part the assessment of the truth of religious interpretations, has implications for understanding the truth of one's own religious tradition. Truth within one's own tradition needs to be treated contextually, just as it is to be contextualized in examining the interpretations of others. With that in mind, we can abandon the nonsense of saying that, for instance, Christianity is wholly true, and ask instead what kind of Christianity makes a valid truth claim in the specific contexts under consideration. In contexts where Roman Catholicism of a certain particular sort is true, Methodism might not be true, and vice versa. Or perhaps a generous person would see that in contexts where a particular Roman Catholic interpretation is true, a Wesleyan interpretation might be equally true because complementary. The point is that the assessment of truth is an empirical inquiry determining whether what is important or valuable in the religious object is carried over into the interpreter in the respect in which the symbols interpret the object relative to all the contextual variables. We are accustomed to think that the truth of a particular religion should be judged by theologians attached to that religion. Practically speaking, those are the people most likely to have an interest to learn enough of the subtleties of the contextualized interpretations to do so. Yet there is no reason why a theologian from another tradition might not make equally good judgments in the matter. In fact, given our propensity to self-deception, wisdom suggests that each tradition should hire theologians from other traditions to raise questions of the actual symbol systems at hand, the modes of reference involved, and the contextual factors of social location, cultural values, and purposes. Or, better yet, perhaps we should think of theologians as persons adept at assessing religious truth across a wide variety of contexts. I see no way to avoid reductionism. If we think of theology of world religions as the study of what one religion, say Christianity, ought to think about other religions. On the other hand, we can think of theology of world religions as simply theology, the assessment of religious truth in the various contexts in which it is claimed. One marker to identify contexts is to trace their traditional roots through the history of core texts and motifs. Another marker is to identify contexts is the comparison of religious symbols across different systems. To determine what is true or what is false, however, a theology of symbolic engagement needs to assess context by context what symbols allow for engaged interpretation and whether they in fact deliver over what they promise. Thank you.
Robert Neville, Dean of the Boston University School of Theology, speaking on Toward a Theology of World Religions, the Existential Threats. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15 and includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by John Perotti with help from Boris Strapotsky, Matt Largy, and Matt Odette. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Gina Cervetti. Thanks for joining us.